Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Flywheel, your number one source for everything crypto, DeFi, and all that is in between. If you want to know what's going on in the world on chain, well, you've come to the right place. This is DeFi Dave, here with Capital K, and we are here to help you harness the power of the flywheel. And this time around, we go into the realm of storage. But actually, I don't know if storage does justice to this interview. It does. Yeah. It's like, it's all purpose, computing, messaging, scheduling, like the things that make blockchains and honestly computing like work as is. Like, this is what Sam Williams from Arweave and AO is tackling. And this was a tremendous interview. I don't think I used that before, tremendous, because like what he's built with Arweave and then what he's built on top of it with AO is incredibly powerful. Kit, what are your thoughts?
I think I just really appreciate his philosophy and ethos.
Same.
Into it is that like how like he cares so deeply about user rights, and he sees like the state of the world and how where is heading, and he's like, we're going towards disaster, and I need to step up and build. And I thought that was like so noble, and prescient as well too.
Yeah, it's such a breath of fresh air to have someone on that's value driven. You know, it's crazy. He started Arweave as this kind of like decentralized storage backup, and it's evolved into AO, which is a supercomputer they can like spawn thousands of chains on. And you know, we love to see a story like this, and I can't wait to see this evolve. But before we do, Kit, do you have a disclosure to make?
I do. I am a massive AO fan. Not only that, I have a massive, not massive, but I have an AO position. So with that said, I am biased, but I did do my research and you guys know me. That's all I can say.
Our listeners do know you, or those that have been around. But if you're new here and you want to get to know us, you know what to do. Hit that bell button, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Give us a comment. Let us know what you think. Give us a like. All of it is appreciated. Make sure to follow us on all of our socials on Twitter, TikTok, and Telegram at Flywheel DeFi. You can follow me on Twitter at DeFiDave22.
You can follow me at 0xCapital_K.
And let's get the flywheel spinning. Welcome back to Flywheel. I'm your host, DeFi Dave, here as always with Capital K. And this time around, we go in the land of permanence. We go in the land of forever. We have on the founder of Arweave, Sam Williams. Sam, it's great to have you on. I remember when Arweave first came out 7 years ago, because there was like a few murmurs of like, okay, what does like decentralized storage look like? There's like storage, there's like obviously IPFS and all this hype around Filecoin, like Filecoin being one of the first ICOs in 2017. So it's like always been this persistent theme in like crypto. It's like, oh, you have the financial aspect and oh, you have like this permanent storage aspect, and you've been grinding and working for 7 years, and it's an honor to finally have you on, Sam.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. That sounds fun. I mean, it brings back some memories of the early days. We didn't feel like at the start there were many people really thinking about permanent storage on blockchains. Mm-hmm. I mean, like in the early Bitcoin community, they did. There were lots of experiments before, you know, inscriptions came along. But we thought that that was the obvious opportunity with blockchains. That was what they give you, right? Like decentralized replication of a data set that is in many different places, so many places it can't be easily censored. But like all of the early storage projects actually went a different direction. They were all focused on temporary storage, which we thought was sort of odd at the time.
Yeah. And honestly, when like you think of a blockchain, at least when someone's first getting into blockchain, they're like, oh, wow, it's on this permanent public ledger forever. It's like, wow, that's really special. But is that like not the case? Or is that like what is the case?
Well, that's the case on Arweave. Like
that is the case on Arweave. It is forever.
Actually, I don't like the word forever. I think
Okay, never mind.
It won't, but the marketing people do, because it's simpler to explain than the truth, which is maximum possible time period. So basically, Arweave is an economic model. I mean, let's jump to that in a second. It'll be easier to introduce what it.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's take a step back. So, Sam, you know, let's kick things off here a little softer. You know, let's tell us about your background, like prior to crypto. I saw that you had a lecturing stint as an assistant lecturer at the university for like 3 years. What was your life prior to crypto?
So I was a PhD student, and basically one of my jobs was also helping with the lowlier parts of lecturing, giving like, you know, tutorials to people, that type of thing. And I was super interested in distributed systems. And I found Bitcoin, I don't know the year, it was like 2010, 2011, very, very, very early. And I thought it was super cool because it was a distributed system, but also decentralized, where it kind of carried the torch of BitTorrent in some senses, which I was also super interested in, because it's a very cool technology that you can just share data around the world without a leader. And BitTorrent is really the, well, actually, no, I guess it's a P2P networks before that, like Nutella. There were some, but BitTorrent was really the thing that...
Yeah. Really going down memory lane industry. Here.
Yeah, yeah, right.
LimeWire.
LimeWire.
LimeWire. My computer's still recovering from that.
Oh, yeah, right. All of these files are suspiciously end in .exe and are 634 kilobytes precisely. That claim to be whatever song you want. Anyway, I was really interested in that distributed data technology, basically. And in my academic life, I'd taken this route, which was building distributed operating systems. And we saw that kernel of something cool in Bitcoin, which is this idea that it replicates data in many, many places, and it doesn't last forever, but it lasts until the blockchain dies, whenever that happens to be. Mm-hmm. And we thought, well, why can't we take that further? Like, that's something, like, wouldn't it be great to build an archive of all of human knowledge and history that would outlast all of us by far, and, you know, well into the distant future, like the maximum possible time period is how we like to describe it in precise terms. And so we built a mechanism that replaces the mining algorithm of Bitcoin with the production of proofs of storage of data. And so basically, when you mine Arweave, you mine with your hard drive. You download the data set, you replicate it. There are incentives to make sure there's a full replication of the Weave. And then we had to come up with an economic system that made that work, because it's kind of okay for Bitcoin because it's very small amounts of data. But when you make it arbitrarily scalable, which was exactly, you know, what we wanted to do with Arweave and what we did do in the end, you have to find a way to pay for it. And so we essentially realized the only rational way to pay for permanent storage looks like a transparent risk model around an endowment, essentially. So you pay for 200 years worth of storage, and as the cost of storage declines over time, that 200 years expands out. And so peculiarly, if the cost of storage declines at a rate higher than 0.5%, if the token price stays stable, then you end up with more or equal storage purchasing power in the following year.
20 years later.
And if the token price even declines, actually the cost of storage and the token price, they kind of chase each other in this model. So in most reasonable simulations of a run of it, it lasts for like extraordinarily long time periods. So not like forever, not longer than the heat death of the universe, but like we say engineered to store data for the maximum possible time period with a transparent risk model that you can audit yourself, so you can, you know how to trust it.
AKA forever. I'm just kidding.
The marketing people don't like me for not liking the forever word, because it's an awful lot easier to say.
Definitely putting all of that into forever-ish.
Forever-ish. We'll do that. Forever-ish.
You know, okay, all right. So thank you for that introduction. And, you know, before we dive in here, though, I just caught a clip of the latest AO promo video here, and you said something that really caught me at the end is, you know, you deserve to speak online, you deserve to consume the content you want, and you deserve to own your content. But these rights won't be given to you unprompted. The tech is here today, and it is our fight to lose. Let's fucking go. Could you dive into that? Let's unpack that. Like, what do you mean by that? Like, what are user rights to you? What's your philosophy behind development? And like, what is your crypto ethos?
Yeah, I think that the reason protocols are exciting is because they give users guaranteed immutable rights. And if they don't do that, mm-hmm. then we should all just go back to Web 2. Like, it's an awful lot easier. But the idea that we can produce web services and the idea of the PermaWeb, this thing we're building on top of Arweave, is to take the properties of blockchain, if you will. Now we've applied them to data, mm-hmm. to apply them downstream to all of the things that are composed of data. And it turns out that is mm-hmm. basically every single web application you can think of. And now with AO, we realize the financial system too. Money is just information.
Right.
But yes, so trying to build a cyberspace where user rights are guaranteed in the same way a constitution might try to give you rights in the real world, but this time enforced by math and code. And so with Arweave, we basically built it to be arbitrarily scalable. And I know I'm getting over specific on the details today, but it's like, choose a pair. Yeah,
this is a podcast where you get over specific. Don't worry.
Yeah, okay. We're definitely going to dive in. Yeah.
But no, it's from social contracts to smart contracts.
Yeah, I like that. That's right. Yeah. And social contracts in the real world, you know, when we think about the web services we use, they're all kind of just hopes. Like, we just provision a service given to us by a company and we hope that they won't screw us over too much in the future. And that sounds like a terrible world to live in. And I guess our core philosophy at Forward Research is that we see that ever greater portions of human attention, time, is being spent in a way that you can reasonably call in cyberspace. Like, this interaction we're having right now, I don't know about you guys, but I'm not particularly aware of the peripheral physical world. We're just in an experience together,
right,
which is coming to us through computers. And the way that cyberspace is structured on the centralized web is that all of the services we use are just at the behest of a company. We have no rights here. And you know, it's not like we should be begging Facebook not to censor us. It's fair enough. It's their private property. It's their service. They own them.
It's we should just be
building their,
right.
their,
it's their prerogative.
Yeah, that's how I think of all this. Yeah.
But we should instead be building services that just give rights to users in a way that they can't be taken away. So one of the big things we did with Arweave, to the philosophy you mentioned or ethos, is that we built as a community a set of principles, basic, mm-hmm. Fundamental sort of rights that the network is intended to impart to its users. And as soon as we did this, the core builders of the Arweave protocol implementations, we went to all of the main people in the ecosystem. We told them, if we ever propose something that is against these, don't let us, like, don't adopt the software. This should be out of our control and should be out of everyone's control. Not a DAO either. It's just an immutable constitution, basically. And because the protocol is structured that way, those same rights are transferred downstream to the other applications that are built on top of it. And it creates this permanent web full of services that give you essentially the technical equivalent of constitutional rights.
Yeah, no, that's very powerful. And one thing you also said that really resonated with me was that if a protocol can change its rule, if you have a roadmap, then you're still an incomplete product, right?
I think that's definitely true. Yeah.
With that said, though, like, when you conceived of Arweave, like, obviously Arweave figured out its PMF and hit like 15% of the index web, but you had to think of Arweave's this mechanism and tokenomics design before Arweave was live and thought about it, right? Did you ever go back and be like, what if it didn't work? What if it didn't hit PMF? Then, well, we can't update, you know, our product stack. So would you have to start over, or had you given any thought to the counter negative here?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, Arweave came from, those are always our principles. We always wanted to abide by that. We never did have a roadmap after Arweave was on mainnet.
It sounds bullish. No roadmap.
No roadmap.
It's like, this is the right curve roadmap. It's like, we're doing this huge.
No roadmap.
I think, hold on.
Yeah, exactly. This is the destination.
Sorry, we are here. Headphones. There we go.
Mm-hmm. the way that we see it is that you can build stuff on top. You should be focused on adoption once you're calling it a protocol. Like once it's a mainnet, the game is to get people to use it. That's not a roadmap per se, but it is. There's still a ton of work to be done on adoption, which is what we've been doing the last 7 or 6 years. But yeah, if the protocol is changing all the time, then it's just not offering its users rights that they can trust will be there a year from now because you might change it. And I think this is unfortunately the case with virtually everything apart from Bitcoin. And we really try to hold Arweave to that standard, but we're not like Bitcoin yet. Pretty close, but you know.
Nice.
Yeah. I think the rest of the industry is, you know.
I have a question from one of the interviews you did. You had like an actual hot take. Like people are like have hot takes, but they're really like lukewarm. But this is an actual hot take. And you basically said like, yeah, like Ethereum like doesn't work. You basically said something along the lines of Ethereum is so hands-on because it doesn't work. Can you like dive into that more? Because I think like maybe like 4 years ago, people didn't really see that because it was like the best thing out there. But now we have like different blockchains, different solutions out there. And you see like this common like theme of like people say, oh, Ethereum is mid-curving it. And does that count for like the EVM? Like, are you talking about like Ethereum? Or are you talking about the EVM as well? But yeah, like get into it.
Yeah. So to set some context, I think Ethereum was a really incredible innovation. And it allowed us to do something that was basically as a generalized consensus mechanism, right? Like way back in the early days, just after Bitcoin started, there was a bunch of innovation happening in different consensus mechanisms. And it was pretty interesting. Arweave to some extent, it's like a derivation of that trend 5 years down the line. But Ethereum just made it so that you could say, well, Arweave, you have all these like very, very large 256 kilobytes, but large for a blockchain, large proofs and stuff. So you can't just embed it inside something like Ethereum. But most stuff like running a Uniswap, you know, if you tried to build a Uniswap before Ethereum, you would be building your own blockchain. So there was a real profound innovation there. But what happened was they built an sort of MVP, or really, I could be even just a prototype. And like, if you go back in the documentation about Ethereum, that's more or less how they described it at the time. You know, they had this whole like vision for a big stack they were going to build. They ended up really just building this one core component. And they had this really dangerous effect that you sometimes get in protocol adoption. So there's this RFC about protocol adoption. It was written long before crypto came along, which is basically a look back at 30 years worth of, what digital protocol adoption rates looked like and what the different patterns were and trends, because, you know, this is not new to blockchain. It's actually been around for a long time. And one of the key takeaways they have in that report is that you mustn't have scaling limits in your protocol. Otherwise, it's over. It's not going to work. And the reason is because a protocol is a shared language for achieving a task together, right? It is social consensus around a way of doing something. And if you go down that route and you build a large number of stakeholders, which Ethereum did very quickly, but they reach a point where it's just like, oh, it doesn't scale. We have to change something fundamental about the protocol. And unfortunately, with scaling, particularly with what's called global shared memory, this idea that basically when you access the memory of Ethereum, I can't. And so we must form a queue. Everyone must serially form a queue to access its state transition mechanism. If there is no solution to that that doesn't require you to move in the design space and trade-off space, no, you can't do that when you have stakeholders, because some of those stakeholders were relying on the current trade-off space. And then they just got bogged down in this quagmire. It's not even my hot take, it's actually Vitalik's hot take from about 2016, 2017, where he said on Twitter one time, I think the phrasing was, exorbitantly high gas fees are a default liveness failure. Okay, yeah, I think that's probably true. And we've been in that position for, Well, the whole time. Ethereum just turned 9. Yeah. I don't think it works. And that's why they're hands-on trying to fix it all the time. Like, it can't be a real protocol because it doesn't scale. And it also means you can't depend on it and rely on it. And so... So, I love Ethereum, but also, like, I still hold tokens from the ICO.
them. Wow.
Diamond hands.
To be clear. Like, really, really tiny amount.
So what do you think of the EVM then? Does that, like, count in that or no?
There are things about the EVM that make it very difficult to memory segment. Mm-hmm. So it was designed as this MVP, as, like, okay, everything shares the memory. And so there's... not like built directly into it, the idea that this transaction will edit this piece of memory and subsequently you can sort of shard out the memory space downstream. But it's not, this is like, it's definitely not the worst part of Ethereum. And I also feel like, you know, I was not a huge fan of JavaScript and yet JavaScript took over everything. And now actually when I write code, like as long as it's not AOS or I very rarely write Erlang code, lots of Lua code for AO, but the rest of the time it's in JavaScript. Everyone just kind of adopted it. JavaScript's a crazy language, but these things become standards as long as they're not so obscenely crazy that they're like just don't work. And I think that's what we're seeing with Ethereum base layer.
So it's like one more question before we get back to AO. Do you think Ethereum is too far gone? Is there like anything that could be done to like quote unquote save Ethereum, or is like the splurge, purge, merge, blurge, like is it too much?
The Ethereum's real problem now is it's being eaten by the L2s. So they may act very friendly, but really what they're doing is just accruing the Ethereum user base to bring them to their own networks, which right now are sort of paying their dues, if you will, by uploading their state transition rollups, basically like vaguely compressed version of transactions that are going on. But when that becomes too expensive, which it's already pretty expensive to run a rollup on Ethereum that has any real traffic, they will just inevitably use something like Celestia or build their own. And they will absorb those communities. Like really the idea that, you know, you need to exit to L1, your liquidity is actually not very coherent. Like it doesn't, okay, just imagine if that happened. Well, for a start, most of the rollups haven't implemented it. Like if you go to, what's it called? L2 Beat. It's a great site where you can actually look at the state of the technology of the rollups. Most of them are like totally detached chains. Lots don't even have clients. Some of them you can't even get the state transitions at all anywhere. It's just a centralized server. The idea that they need to pay extremely high gas fees to access that service that users just don't appear to be demanding, doesn't make sense. And then you get this super weird set of incentives as well between the stakers and the subsequent APY that they're making downstream, and the scarcity of block space in Ethereum, right? So if there was only one transaction per block and people really still wanted to access that transaction or to be the person that placed that transaction, then the APY would go up, right? And so actually the stakers are inversely, they're incentivized inversely proportional to the scalability of the chain. So it's rent seeking, essentially. Everybody in ETHland knows that we could increase the gas limit pretty substantially, and the stakers can vote to do so per block. But we don't. Why don't we? Well, there's no economic incentive to do so. Like the rollups that everyone is willing to pay this price to access Ethereum today. So, okay, leave it as is. And then maybe when they start to move to Celestia or some other DA, maybe that will change, and then they can like make Ethereum essentially more scalable.
Right. They have to compete against value.
It's rent extraction.
Yeah, I just saw the other day, it must have been yesterday, like Optimism, the super chain. We're not in L2, we're the super chain. So that's literally coming to fruition. I'd say though, Ethereum's biggest strain, honestly, is ETH as an asset and ETH as a store of value. and the fact that it's being used as a gas token, not just on mainnet, but like all the major L2s, its strength as an asset itself is probably like Ethereum's biggest strength at the moment.
Maybe. It just reminded me of, I watched a podcast in like 2021, 22. Mm-hmm. I forget the name. I know the, avatar that they use on Twitter, and it was on the podcast, but, and this guy was saying, Solana is going nowhere. ETH will always be ultrasound money because everyone will just, use ETH. And I don't know, 2 years, these things unfold very, very slowly. Like IBM is still a company that makes computers. But I just don't see it going well. And they're getting hyper fragmentation. Like, ironically, the structure they're ending up with, which is many parallel threads and then message passing between them, but they've got a million different message passing like networks, is probably the right way to go. And it also, deep irony, was the same structure that Vitalik was proposing with sharding in 2017, 2018 period. Should just kept with it. Mm-hmm.
Why didn't they keep with it?
Well, because they had all those stakeholders that like sharding would mean that the global shared state would have to die, which ironically it has now anyway.
It's right? Already,
It has a with bunch each of L2 versions. Chart, don't share state. But we got to it the hard way, I guess, rather than the, what'd you say, short-term painful, but long-term more cohesive way, which would have just been implement many different ledgers that all roll up in one way or another to a large data storage tank. This kind of leads us to AO, because that's exactly what it is. And then have message passing between them, which isn't quite like the way they were doing it with sharding, but they could have easily added message passing when they realized that was the right route later. But
Okay. Then let's kind of dive into that then. Actually, before we do that, could you give me a nice 30-second soundbite about what Arweave is so that we can make a nice clip of it?
Oh, sure. Arweave is a permanent data storage system. It does on-chain storage at arbitrary scale. So much storage that now it has 15% of the number of accessible items on the indexed web are stored inside the permaweb on Arweave as well. You can use it to build virtually endless different things. Really, the idea is to decentralize data, and then it turns out almost everything in cyberspace is some derivation of data. Okay, not sure if that's the 30 seconds you wanted, but that's the first thing that came to mind.
Okay, that's good enough. And why the elephant as a mascot? Because of long-term memory or?
Yes, exactly. An elephant never forgets.
Perfect.
He's called Winston after Winston. The new character of 1984.
Winston. Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, that's like so the good. The port Arweave uses is 1984. All of the nodes talk to each other on that. And the minimum quantity of its tokens is a Winston after Winston Smith, the main character.
It's got a flashback to high school, just like having to read 1984.
Having to read. You make it sound like a chore.
No, I love that book too. Like, I mean, it was assigned. No, I enjoyed the book. It wasn't a chore. Definitely very poignant. But go ahead, Kate.
And now let's kind of switch gears to this new thing that you're building. And it kind of tapped into kind of two underlying trends that we saw in this cycle on like the more product and tech stack front is the modularity and parallelization, right? Like these are two trends that really emerged like this cycle pushing through. You know, we see from obviously modularity, you think of Celestia right away, right? But in reality, it's everything that we've done, right? All the rollups are technically quote unquote modular. Then there's parallelization, right? With the Monad, the Say, and Sui and Aptos and all of those guys starting emerging and coming through. But now we have AO. Like, could you share what is AO's approach to modularity and parallelization? But first, like, what is AO?
Okay, put simply, AO is a decentralized supercomputer that runs on top of Arweave. The idea is that you can have any number of parallel processes. You can think of those like threads on a normal computer or smart contracts in a decentralized compute network. And they all roll up onto Arweave. And then instead of interacting with global shared memory, they send messages to one another. And so it essentially means that every single smart contract runs in parallel with its own throughput of a single chain. This allows you to scale decentralized applications in exactly the way that you would scale a centralized application, which is, well, you don't just magically hope that the CPU is going to like get, call it vertically, faster kind of in the number of cycles it can do per second. Instead, what you do is you just make it so that you can split the workload across many CPUs, many threads, which is the same as many processes in AO. And we built it after a system called Erlang, which there's a good likelihood some of the packets that we're sending between our computers here are routed through an Erlang machine somewhere down the line. It runs a huge amount of infrastructure. It's built for telephony applications, packet switching, basically, or telephone call switching. And that was a problem set where they needed to be massively parallel. You need to be able to throw an enormous number of cores at it and just have it scale so that you can process more interactions. And before, to wind this back to like where Arweave started, before Arweave, I was doing a PhD in distributed operating system design. I was essentially porting Erlang to run on bare metal machines so that each core in the machine was an individual computer, if you will, in a network, so that you could have one or more of those fail and then have resilient, trustless failover, basically inside a machine. So if something in the hardware goes wrong, then the machine continues running for like really, really long running applications. But when we acquired Odyssey last year, which is like a decentralized social media network, want to decentralize it on, well, it's sort of a, to be honest, it's like a wants to be decentralized Web3 inverted commas a video platform at the moment. Like there are some parts of it, like some metadata was stored on a blockchain, but sure, the rest is centralized. We acquired it in order to decentralize it properly on top of the Perm Web stack that we've been building. And one of the things we needed there was the ability for 8 million monthly active users to trade rights in the content. And we were looking at the smart contract systems that already existed and just like, there's nothing that will scale to this level. So let's just do that thing that with that kind of background in normal distributed systems looked obvious to us, which is local memory that is private and then just send messages around the system in order to achieve parallelism. And we just so happened to be like sitting on top of Arweave, which is the perfect substrate for message passing bus. It's like a global decentralized message passing bus. And so we plug the two sides together. There's a bunch more complexity to it, but at the other side, you get the ability to run any number of computations at the same time and then have them orchestrate by sending messages rather than sharing memory. And weirdly, we thought that this would be like a very difficult idea to explain to people why that was preferable. But surprisingly, when we launched it, like the amount of traction was incredible very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. We really didn't expect this. Like to explain Arweave took years and years, but AO people got in like a week. It was really, people just seemed to click with it. It's like, oh, I see, rollups are cool. What if instead of 8 rollups we have, like on the test net right now, there's 110,000, but it could be 10 million. It would make no difference. That makes sense. And so here we are.
Yeah, I definitely feel like AO came out at the right time where a lot of people are very familiarized with like all this concept of modularity and all concept of parallelization. And particularly with the modularity side, like any VM can run on AO, right? Because all you're really passing is just the message at the end of the day that comes through between each process, which is a smart contract equivalent on AO.
Yeah, exactly. It's basic. So we started building AO just as a data protocol on Arweave. So just a way to express, and you can actually think of them kind of like blockchains, basically. Like that smart, if you have a smart contract alone, in just like a, okay, maybe we should wind it back to those rollups. They're transmitting blobs of interactions, right? And the central observation there is that you don't need to come to consensus about the state transitions of the program. you actually just need to come to consensus about the deterministic virtual machine that it's going to use, the initial state, the program itself, and then the list of interactions. And then you imply a state of the program that can be computed by anyone at any time without actually computing it at the time you come to consensus about its addition to the system, basically. And so, yes, we just made it so that you can do that for each individual smart contract. And the data protocol itself just specifies, use this virtual machine. And, well, really just those things I outlined. It's really just that as a data format. The idea being to try and make something that's like TCP/IP for computation, basically. And then you store all of that on Arweave, and then you add a couple more components, like a decentralized computation network, so that you can actually resolve all of those states, because you actually, as a user, don't care quite so much that it's just been written. You want to know, you want to know what's happened.
You got to run it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then like an embedded messaging relay network, which uses Arweave as its backbone to transport the packets, basically packet equivalents between the different smart contracts. You add it all up and it just gives you like a decentralized supercomputer.
Perfect. And Dave, question?
Yeah. So when I hear messaging and I hear a bunch of rollups and chains, I think of things like Cosmos and IBC. I think of things Polkadot. So how does AO compare to IBC and Polkadot?
Yeah. Arweave is the difference, I guess.
Arweave. Oh, yes. Okay.
But because basically the idea with Polkadot and Cosmos is that you are going to have a set of your own nodes that only look at your thread, right, and execute the interactions on it and replicate that data between them. By using Arweave, this like arbitrarily scalable, decentralized, permanent data store as the message bus, then you solve that problem of bootstrapping per process in our model, but it would be per chain in their model. And then similarly, we share the security mechanism, that bridging component, basically, between all of the different processes in one combined pool, rather than having to bootstrap your own security. And so those experiments have the right sort of base idea, but bring your own security means that like booting up a new chain is like a multi-$100 million process and takes years. Mm-hmm. Whereas in AO, because they all share the same generic infrastructure and security mechanisms, then like a single command, a single instruction from one process can actually spawn another one. So quite normal way of using the system is like, okay, I got to do a bunch of parallel computation. It's going to be faster if I do it in parallel. So I'll just spin up 25 or 100 or 1,000 other processes and go execute the computation there. And then they'll send a message back to me with the result, which is exactly how you'd scale things in a normal Web2 environment. But just now you can do it in the decentralized space too.
And was this your intention? Or this is kind of like you just discovered this later, like, oh, wait, we can like actually just spawn like 1,000 chains right here.
Our intention when we built Arweave, definitely not. In fact, when we first built Arweave, I would say the only time that Arweave really changed its mission a little bit was, yes, it's a permanent information storage system, but we were really focused on just like records of history. Mm-hmm. And then there was a moment, I think near the launch of the mainnet to 6 months afterwards, where we were thinking about it and we started to see that, well, you know, you're storing web pages inside this thing. Why do they have to be like backups? Why couldn't they be the primary source?
E-website.
And that was when the idea of the perm web was made. And, you know, that was the one major edit there. But
that's more like an evolution than an edit.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Go ahead.
You were mentioning earlier, what would you do if you didn't find product market fit? It's like, we didn't do this to find product market fit. We did this because we wanted the thing to exist. And we were going to work at it until it did. It's not good founder talk, but it's honest. Like, we just really wanted... I don't want to live in a world where ever more of... But our attention and our time and the things that are important to us live in cyberspace, and that cyberspace doesn't give us any rights. It sounds terrible. And so we're just going to do it either way.
I can see how 1984 is the it's a big theme here.
Yeah, for sure. Make the memory hole impossible.
Make the memory hole impossible. And I thought it was interesting, like something I wanted to ask you as like a builder in the space for 7 years, especially when you just said like, we didn't build this to find product market fit, which seems like what every founder is trying to do. Even worse, it seems like founders are just trying to find narrative market fit. It's like, oh, like what magic words do I need to say to get like the, it's like casting a spell. Like, oh, wow, here's like money for me to build my product, blah, blah, blah. But you said like, no, we like wanted to do this to like make it work. It was a much more like core mission. So I guess this was like, I like to call this thing like your why, like your reasoning, like keep going and like pushing, especially through two bear markets. Can you give like kind of like a lowdown and some advice to founders, like what it's like to build into bear markets? What were your experiences back in like 2018, 2019 during those dark times? And then like this past one dark. In like 2022, 2023.
Honestly, that would be a long answer. I'll try and distill it. So first thing is have a good why is actually exactly how I describe it to new founders building in the ecosystem. Because particularly if they come into this world on a sort of sunny day, right? Mm-hmm. we all here know that there are many pretty brutal dark days.
Stone ages.
Yeah.
Like stone ages.
Yeah. Having a good why will carry you through the darker moments. And so, and I think my personal philosophy, like people need money to live. That's definitely true. But you don't really, like it's diminishing returns. So just going out to just make as much money as you possibly can, like after a certain point that, like you have to find something else that is meaningful to you or worthwhile. And I would argue you should even start there, because actually if you start with a meaningful objective, and to us it was, make a permanent record of history such that no single person or authority or country even can just airbrush the truth away. Make it so there's like a neutral and well-replicated kind of tome of all of human history. That was something that we thought was really meaningful and worth way more than, you know, just like chasing whatever the hot narrative is today. And it carried us through, like, I think the first bear market was much worse than second. Yeah. Carried us through those dark times. And it was like, you know, when everything in the world tells you to stop doing it, it's like, well, if we don't do it, is anyone going to do it? Doesn't seem obvious. And look, we're in this position where we actually might stand a chance to do it. So better get on with it. And never really wavered from that. That was very helpful. But if you don't have a why, I would stop whatever random thing you're working on and go find that first and then commit yourself to it. Another thing that's useful there is like, if you are the most passionate person in the world about your particular problem, there's a pretty high likelihood that you're going to build the best solution as well, which is very helpful. if you don't really care about your problem, you know, the passion doesn't come easy. And then all of the endless work and the struggle is like, you're kind of moving even further uphill. Whereas the person that really cares about what they're doing, it's kind of easier because you have that intrinsic drive to have it happen for some higher meaning than just money, which really after some point, it's like logarithmically interesting, if that makes sense. If you don't have any of it, then it's very important. And the more you have, the less important this individual dollar becomes. I know there's tons to say there, but
that's great. That's great. I'm glad you're able to distill it. And like social simile is like, you know, find your why and then you figure out the how later. Right. And then you just, I like what you said, better get on with it. That's literally, that should be the model. You already figured out your why, you better get on with it. And speaking of that, let's, go ahead.
Well, you basically gave a Nietzsche quote. I don't know if it's deliberate or not. He said, the man that has a why can bear almost any how. is pretty much correct as far as I can tell.
I did not know that, but yes, let's say I did quote Nietzsche right there.
Neo Nietzsche over here.
That's very niche of you, pun intended.
Nice, nice.
Nice.
Sorry. Okay, so let's kind of get back to this, and I want to get a bit more technical here, and let's dive into how you said like each smart contract is effectively a process on AO, and if this process is getting inundated with a ton of pings, you would just paralyze by launching another process.
Yep.
Conceptually, I get that. That's obvious, right? Hey, if this lane is full, let me switch lanes and go into this one, which is open. I get that. But then how does it work in, say, an application, like a real app? Let's say for a Uniswap liquidity pool, for example. Everyone is accessing this one, like this meme coin, you know, on Solana or whatever. I'm trying to ape into this coin, but my transactions are failing. I can't just fork a pool for myself to use and then hit that.
That'd be pretty cool if you could.
Yeah, you. Okay, so a real world example, not a liquidity pool, but an on-chain order book, because you can do this when you have arbitrary horizontal scalability. Sure. Yes, you have. So UCM in V1.2, whatever, comes out in a couple of weeks. The way that it works is there's like an index process. So you want to trade some asset or look what the assets are available. You ping that and it says, here's a list of all of the addresses for the processes that host the order books for those individual items. And say there's like, I don't know, five or six super, super popular order books, but they're all running in parallel. So it doesn't matter how many people are interacting on those. They don't affect each other and they don't affect the downstream. Less popular order books. But if you think about those top five or six that are super popular, okay, so maybe there's like you've capped out the scalability of that one process, just like you would in Web 2. Well, there's many things you can do, but I think we have someone on our team that literally built part of the Swiss Stock Exchange, so I should ask him. But the sensible way to do this in Web 2 world as well as Web 3 would be, okay, just make multiple order books. And then you create the opportunity for arbitrage between them. And maybe you do that arbitrage yourself to make it seem like there's one when there are actually many underneath. You can have like autonomous bots do that for you. Or you can have them like orchestrate a little bit and send messages around. But basically the net effect is that you just do what you would do in Web 2 to make it scale. It's just that now it's on a decentralized compute substrate. And so, yeah, you have any number of these parallel order books for the same tokens, and you just arbitrage between them and has the effect of producing one order book.
Okay, I get that. In the order book sense, since the liquidity is kind of like segmented for you like that, and you can just spin up another one and you can just arb away any difference. But in our current state where on DeFi, most things are still in this like AMM, kind of model, like does parallelizing that works with an AMM or not really?
Yeah, for sure. Like, okay, if you didn't want to just make multiple liquidity pools and then arb between them, which would also work totally fine, you could do something like bundle, basically combine them. So have trees of processes where you say, okay, here's the flow from one side, here's the flow from that side, and then you resolve it in one. It's like a tree-based concurrency model. MapReduce, if you're familiar with.
This is like taking Uniswap V3, where it's like different buckets of liquidity, but to another level. That's what I think of it as.
Yeah, but to be honest, like I don't think that AMMs will be the most popular route for trading in one arbitrarily parallel system. Like there's really no reason not to use an order book. Like an order book is the matching engine, and then you can add liquidity on top. There's a reason that all of the TradFi exchanges do not use AMMs.
AMMs.
They use real market makers. And one of the cool things that people are starting to experiment with, end of theorizing stage, starting to experiment stage in AO is the idea of building fully autonomous market making bots. So they are automated market makers, but they're way more complex in strategy, way closer to a traditional market maker that runs fully autonomously on the chain, which you can do because when you have this separation, making private the flow of inputs to a smart contract, so making them non-dependent on each other, independent from one another, then you can do really large amounts of computation. Because it's essentially, well, the only people that have to actually execute that computation are the people that are interested in the outputs. And that's just something you get by deferring execution, essentially, right? So writing your roll-up, if you will, coming to consensus about the availability of the data, then doing your computation later means that, well, there's really no reason you can't do really huge amounts of computation, like running LLMs on-chain, which people have done in practice now, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. I see that as well too. And I'm just trying, because I've done a ton of AO research and read a lot, but no one was able to explain to me the brass tacks of it. Like, for example, if I wanted to do a flash loan and touching multiple processes at the same time, since there isn't a global share state, I would have to hit each local state at the right time, or how does that work?
No, that's actually a fair point. When you lose global shared state, that's just something that is out of the trade-off space. So trade-off, you get arbitrary scalability, but a flash loan would be pretty hard to engineer. Not necessarily impossible, but way harder than, I mean, the reason you can do it in Ethereum is because you can say, look, no one else in the world is going to be able to touch the computation state for the next few hundred milliseconds while I, or 50 milliseconds maybe, while I do my interaction, which is a cool thing, don't get me wrong, but it's not worth throwing away the whole scalability of throwing away the whole financial system for, essentially. Like, the existing TradFi financial system is a message passing system. All of the banks maintain their own servers and they send messages, packets between them. Which means you can do all of that stuff, all of the intelligence that was previously off-chain, all of that can be now.
What is off-chain, you can do on-chain.
Yeah, 100%. And I get that. Could you imagine if we had flash loans in
the real world? Like it's hypothetically. Imagine if all the banks were in the same shared state, and then you just had some crazy actor arbitrager go and do a flash loan on JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs. That would be nuts.
I guess you can do something very similar with just collateralized short-term loans.
Virtually. You call your prime broker and be like, I need you to send me 5 yards right now for me to liquidate JP Morgan here, and then I'll send it back to you.
I get you back, please.
Next 15 microseconds.
Exactly. Okay, yeah. Cool. All right. So I get that. There are definitely trade-offs. But one thing about these trade-offs is I feel worth it is the security element, right? Could you kind of walk us through a little bit about AR security and how that supplements and add to AO's security?
Yeah, so AR security, Arweave security, is basically purely focused on data. And he wants to make sure the data is available. AO is if you really want to get into the brass tacks of how it works, I can describe the system, but it's going to be 5 minutes-ish.
Yeah,
do it.
Let's do it.
Okay, cool. So the way it works is that we basically take all the elements that you need in a blockchain computation environment and split them into different sub-networks. The base, if you will, the thing on which everything else runs, is Arweave, which is a global message passing bus. It's kind of like this giant data lake. You throw in a message, and that message it's on this process, it's from this person with certain signatures, and it's in slot number 7, or 7 million, whatever it is. And then you can pull all of those back, and Arweave just makes them permanently available. And then you can recreate essentially the state of a process at any time. So then there are 3 other subnetworks on top. There's a messaging unit network, a scheduling unit network, and a compute unit network. Moves, coos, and sues for short. And when the user wants to interact with the system, they would send a message to their messaging unit. And basically this acts as their, I guess the closest analogy is the RPC node, something like this in Solana or Ethereum, or a gateway in Arweave or IPFS. And it sits there and you say, look, please push this message around the system for me. And the message is just data, right? And so first you send it to the scheduler, who gives it a slot assignment in the flow, for, for a particular process, and you have to find the scheduling unit that is associated with that process. And then you, as the messaging unit, would ask the compute unit, any compute unit, whoever is free, basically, and cheap, and also will provide enough stake against the result. Hey, what was the outcome of this computation? And they go and execute it for you. And then maybe it has more messages, right? So if I do a transfer, then I send, you know, a token to Dave, then the transfer message itself will lead to two other messages, one a credit notice and one a debit notice. And then the messaging unit will take those and send them to the right scheduling units for each of those processes and push them around the system again, and just keeps going until it stops. Essentially, we used to call it cranking, because it's kind of like you crank the handle on the machine and push the information around. That's the broad picture of it. And we designed it very carefully such that each of those subnets has no scalability limit. And then you construct on top of that, which is actually easier problem to solve in units than if you were to try and solve it all together in one go. But you can think of it like there's a computation network, a peer-to-peer computation network. There's a peer-to-peer scheduling network, which is kind of like sequences for hire, something like that, like a generalized set of sequences. Mm-hmm. And anyone can add more capacity if they want. And you just have a market between them to you know, provide good pricing to users. And then a kind of like a routers for hire. It's not quite such a good analogy for that one.
Sequencers for hire, routers for hire, computation for hire.
Exactly. And then we try to make it so that each of those subnets is not only arbitrarily scalable, like has no practical scalability limits, but also it generates an efficient peer-to-peer market for its services on its own as a separated system. So anyone can come along and add more computation or add more relay power or add more schedulers. And then they just compete with one another to get the price down to the lowest possible point. So you end up with an efficient market. And then the user pays the messaging unit. Well, they could, in theory, pay each one of, like, they don't even need to use the messaging unit if they don't want to. They could pay each of the individual ones, but it works as like an orchestration layer. And you just pay in some token, Arweave tokens, AO tokens, even fiat potentially. And then it will just go and orchestrate all of the interactions that have to happen, paying all of the different nodes underneath. And then there's also a security mechanism for message passing on top, but that's enough in one go.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. That's a
Did you
a
say fiat potentially?
There.
Wait.
Yeah. How would that work?
Well, it's pretty simple. Like you top up with a messaging unit, and you give it like $10 or something. And then on your behalf, it will go and provision the services. And so it pays in tokens underneath.
Okay.
But there's really no reason that it shouldn't charge you in dollars if you wanted to.
Not just stablecoins, just straight dollars.
Straight up dollars. Yeah. That's how like a lot of interactions with Arweave now happen as well.
Yeah.
There are bundling nodes. You just pay them $10 and then you send data items to them and they put them into bundles, send them to the network. That's actually how I use Arweave mostly. I never keep any tokens on my machines. So,
makes sense. That makes sense. It's like, imagine the internet today. It's like when you purchase something on Amazon and like, you know, you pay with your credit card, embedded in that credit card payment is like a tiny percentage that is then allocated to paying for the sending of the message, the scheduling of the message, and then the compute.
Ah, good point.
You know, that's kind of the way I see it. But now, the reason why I want to bring up security specifically is Arweave has this, or AO has this modular security, or like on demand, pay what you need level security, right? Like I'm sending Dave $10. I don't need the full faith and power of ETH's $1 billion proof of stake to back that $10 transaction between Dave and I. We're like $11 is enough, you know, like that's like, it's the same as when you order FedEx or UPS and you pay for the maximum level of insurance for your product value in the package. When I'm just sending Dave like a love letter.
Okay, I would be kind of honored if you had like $1 billion of insurance for a love letter.
For the love letter. That's very nice.
Yeah. Actually, no, that's too sentimental. You're right.
But that is essentially what you're doing when you're using Ethereum, except it's not a billion, it's 70 billion. Like you are accessing the full amount of stake in order to send any amount of value. But we didn't, and this has really weird effects, which is like, you know, when you think it through carefully, what you are doing when you pay gas in Ethereum is you are buying access to scarce block space, right? Like you're taking part in a fee market. But what you're really wanting to do is buy security.
Right.
And you are, and it works in the current setup, but it would not work if Ethereum just say it was magically arbitrarily scalable, right? Like if it was infinite vertical compute scaling and there was no block reward. And block rewards are just it's a tax on token holders, put simply, that don't stake. And, you know, okay, you got to bootstrap the network somehow, but that's what it is realistically. So if you were to remove that and have it infinitely vertically scalable, then the transaction fees would drop to virtually zero, which confusingly would mean that the security of the system would drop to virtually zero, and you couldn't just pay for more security. It doesn't work that way. You subsidize it as a group. It's a very odd system. But when we were looking at AO, it was just a case of, well, look, we don't have block space scarcity. So how are you going to make a token model that makes sense? I mean, Arweave does this by you pay 200 years worth of storage costs into the endowment at the start, and that takes a good bunch of tokens out of the supply every time. But how are you going to do this? And those tokens are, you know, taken out in smaller and smaller amounts to pay for security of the base layer. But how would you do this in AO? You just don't have the same setup as something like Ethereum or Solana or Monad even, or the parallel inverted commas chains that do like, yeah, like a few threads, like a handful of threads. You need something completely different. And so we looked at it and we saw, well, what you really need security on is two components, the scheduling, right? So giving those slot assignments, making sure they don't double assign those. Mm-hmm. Yeah, single assignment of slots. And the messages that are being transferred, you need those to be truthful, right? They are basically an oracle. You know, they're like saying, I promise that the state over here is that. And so we realized that the sensible way to approach this is to say, okay, well, what you really want is collateral against dishonesty or fraud. And so you can say, I'm transferring $1. I would like $10 of security. And the recipient can say, okay, Dave has transferred me $1. So says this messaging unit. Well, I'll take $10 of collateral for 2 days worth of fraud detection time. And if it turns out that actually Dave didn't send me that $1, I'll take the $10. Sounds like a reasonable trade. And it's essentially baked into the system like this. So you have insured or collateralized, depending on, you know, different language means the same thing in the end, message passing around the system. And that means that it also takes out tokens from the circulation proportionate to the value of the transfers happening in the system. And that perhaps leads us to the incentive or the token distribution mechanism for AO, which is all about maximizing the amount of value in its economy and the speed at which it moves around, which is what accrues value to the network. So it's the flywheel. Hey, DeFi flywheel. We finally made it.
Let's go take a shot.
Okay, gotcha. And then this security system is, because I'm trying to read through the end of the consensus model is like proof of authority for like the test net, but then it's going to be different for the main net. Is that accurate?
Yeah, right. Yeah, right, so.
Please continue.
Yeah, so the way it works right now is that you just, I mean, it's all layers. So the base AO protocol will not hopefully change very much at all, if any, when we implement proof of stake in the mainnet, which we're now like in the early phases of implementation of. But in the testnet, you just have proof of authority mode. So developers can choose their trusted relays. They say, okay, you know, I trust Dave, I trust Kay. You guys can send me messages, but no one else can. And so you get kind of distribution, but not the normal style of true decentralization, I guess you could say. But yes, you get that in the proof of stake system, but just basically building a layer on top of it.
Right. Because now there's a stake attached to the authority. So you don't have to say, just trust the authority. They have a stake that, hey, you know, if anything bad happens, these guys are underwriting my transactions. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's actually programmable inside the processes how you deal with any message. And so that's really just like a function call that says, is trusted.
I have a non-AO question, and it has to do with, you mentioned like, oh, we don't need like $70 billion to secure a $10 transaction. And when I heard that, the thing I immediately thought of are things like restaking, things coming out like Eigenlayer, like Babylon, like Symbiotic, whatnot, where you're basically having like exactly that. You're having all these different like AVSs go and be like, hey, like we can secure your whatever, so it could be like anything from a rollup to like literally an Oracle to a function. I would love to get your thoughts on the current restaking environment, especially considering your thoughts on Ethereum. Like, what are your thoughts on restaking?
I think pooling responsibility is a generally dangerous, not thing about protocol design is there might be something that looks very dangerous, but if done in precisely the right way, works precisely correctly and safely every single time. But with the general landscape, taking disincentives and socializing them while keeping responsibility private. So for example, something like Lido, actually, where you have each producer can, you know, maneuver certain things. They have responsibility for that private responsibility. But then if something were to go wrong, you socialize the outcome. It's a dangerous design space. In the Ethereum case, it's not actually so many ways it can go wrong. And for something like Solana, even more so, because they just don't have slashing. So there's no disincentive. So you can socialize it however much you like. It doesn't matter, right? but for AO, this is something that, because the security mechanisms are modular, we want to make it so that basically people can decide. And there can be different modes of execution. And the way that it shows in our environment is a little bit more, what do you say? It puts a finer point on it, which is, okay, so you have some stake and you want to pass a message. Well, in the, let's say like default or base case, you just be like, okay, great. I've got $1 million stake, so I can pass, you know, a $10 message for Dave and, you know, $10 message for Kay. Great. Or $1 million perhaps, or, you know, 100,000. But that's essentially double assignment of stake, right? Like you are, giving an assurance, but if you were to resolve all the assurances, you've kind of rehypothecated the stake.
You net negative,
exactly. Which we don't think is the default way people. I mean, there might be certain circumstances where that's fine. Like if it's zero value messages, no harm in being a, you know, message relay. Yeah, then
sure.
But for higher value things, we think the default will likely be I want single assignment of stake to a message over a period of time, and essentially with AO, we achieve that by making a staking process per staker, confusingly. And then we have a Sybil resistance set that watches that each other staker. It's kind of like this many-to-many relationship. So one staker has many watchers, but they also might be watcher for another staker. And then you just basically say, hey, guys, look, I'm assigning... I'm assigning this stake for this period of time to this message. You give them the message, they sign off on it, give you back an attestation, and then you can compile those up, and then you end up a single assignment of stake, so without restaking. But you could also have it if you wanted to. I think that's something that will play out in the wider environment, and we'll just see where people land. But both are supported in AO if you want to.
Mm. Yeah, no, you could do whatever you wish in AO. And in this security context, though, it's like, wouldn't every single dollar that is being staked for a single purpose makes every subsequent dollar more expensive in terms of security? Because now there's less security to kind of go around, right? Because then if I had $1 million, I already securitized, I already secured $500K of it. then the remaining 500K, if you want access, it's just the supply is going down, right? The supply for security is decreasing. And if the demand is there, then pricing for security should go up. No?
Kind of. So you end up with an efficient market, basically. So imagine there's $1 billion staked and people are using like 800 million per day average. And so there's only 200 million free floating. Then yes, you might make access to that stake more expensive, but that incentivizes more people to stake.
Oh, okay.
And fair. That crushes the supply of AO, moves up the price. And so, well, for a start, the original stake, that 800 million that you are using actually becomes a bit more valuable on its own, but then you can also stake more to increase the supply. So eventually you end up with an efficient market. And if you calculate it all downstream, like 10 levels of different derivations, you end up getting to, Oh, I see. The user just pays for the yield for the staker for the time period and the value that they use. And it's just an efficient market on top of that.
Wait, so not only can I decide how much security, I can also decide for how long?
Yes, you need to. Because actually the recipient should. The recipient wants to say, okay.
Right, no chargebacks, frauds. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I want 2 days worth of time for fishermen to basically try and find the fraud. And I can also say, by the way, that collateral, you know, maybe it's 10x the value that's being transferred. Well, 50% of that, so 5x the original value, that could go to the fraud detector. And so intrinsically now you create an incentive for fishermen to execute in the network. And so you don't have to coordinate with them or do anything. You just set the incentive high enough and they will basically resolve the fraud for you and get you your collateral as well as them. And so that's a nice system that avoids having to have like a inflationary block reward forever, basically, that subsidizes these fishermen to run. But yeah, so you have to set a fraud detection time because after that time, then that stake becomes available to reuse and you can go and use it again on some other message.
But then the history of that transaction, like that data goes onto Arweave, which is obviously perma storage. So then do you also decide I only want it for 2 days and bye-bye? No, right? It has to be there for someone else to come in and recreate it. Yeah.
Right. So the scheduling unit is the one that will upload it to Arweave and they actually stake against that. So if they gave something a slot assignment and you can't find it on Arweave, then they can be slashed. But the messaging unit will bundle all of these costs together for you. And so you just pay like one person and then in the background, actually you're paying for access to the scheduler's stake. So you're paying some sort of cost of capital there as well as the scheduler is uploading it to Arweave and it's paying Arweave fees. And also you're paying compute fees and also you're paying for the collateral for the message passing, which there might be a bunch of messages with different values. And there's a lot in the background that is complex, but the user just pays once at the gate, basically.
Yeah, I totally get that. And then, but particularly in the Arweave front, like, do you pay for that 200 years of storage by default, like no matter what the transaction is?
Oh, yes, for sure. And you have to, because you need all of the processes to be replayable. This essentially is like the resolution to the problem that like a blockchain is an ever-growing ledger with nothing to pay for it, typically. And actually, some irony, Arweave is as well. Not the Arweave data set, but Arweave, the literal block headers and stuff, are not incentivized by Arweave, very confusingly. So we periodically upload the block headers into Arweave itself. And it's like Bitcoin would never get large enough that that's a problem. But certainly for other blockchains, if they want to be super scalable, like Solana produces a huge, huge number of vote signatures, and they need to keep all of this stuff in order to keep the chain verifiable. Well, Arweave is a great solution to that because it's just permanent storage. And so you get that like out of the box with AO. You don't have to worry about the replication of the process yourself. You just send it to a scheduler, uploads it to Arweave, then anyone can pull back the computation in the future.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense because I was thinking like if I only pay for 1 year of storage on this transaction and somebody only paid like 1 year for the other, how would I reconcile that in like the 366th day, right? Like half the transaction data is gone. But I get it now. Okay. So just to kind of wrap things up here, Sam, is obviously AO launched with, I think, massive success, right? You guys have accumulated over 600 million in TVL so far in, you know, the pre-bridge per se. And like, you know, what is next though? Like, what does kind of your most exciting things that are coming up, and then what does success look like for Arweave and AO?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're in the very early stages of the AO token mint. I mentioned earlier, like the thing that AO tokens are needed for, and both need for value accrual, is the volume of transactions that are passing through the system. Like, it needs money to move around in order to accrue value. And also you need the tokens in order to secure value moving around. Mm-hmm. It's kind of cyclical. But so the token mint, I think, is pretty cool. Basically, the idea is that anyone can mint them. There's 21 million. There were zero insider sales. We didn't get any tokens for building it. And instead of funding the ecosystem growth by having like a core team that sells tokens in pre-sales, typically like preferentially and without equal access, we just make it so that anyone can stake their tokens at the beginning, as in the pre-bridge mode, and then they can just bridge their assets. And they bridge yield-bearing assets one way or another. And then the yield from that goes to funding the ecosystem through this like decentralized set of about, right now it's six different organizations that are all like core team equivalents. And then they get AO tokens for using it. So it's pretty cool. If you're a user, you just come along, you bridge Ethereum, soon Solana tokens, and you use them in the ecosystem, and you gain ownership of the protocol directly. And at the same time, you subsidize the ecosystem growth efforts of this like wide set for building it. That got to 600 million deposited pretty quickly, which is really awesome to see. I think that will grow, or that just that whole mechanism will grow over time.
What kind of yield bearing assets was it? Just like any LST?
At the moment, it's staked Ethereum, but soon we want to add support for Solana, and we want to make it like a trustless governance model on that. We just want there to be a static, a static policy, and everything can be a viable asset. And like, we'll probably implement some of them because we think that there's a community there, but anyone can also implement a bridge to other networks as long as they pass that criteria for inclusion. And so, yeah, it'll start with Ethereum and Solana, but down the line, I expect there'll be a bunch of others. We think that like basically when you've got the technology right for a smart contracting system, the next big problem is liquidity, right? Because liquidity is such a, you know, it's one of those network effects that has like deep upside if you have it and deep downside if you don't. It's reinforcing one way or the other. If you don't have enough liquidity, builders don't build. If builders don't build, then no one brings liquidity.
The anti-flywheel.
the fly out wheel or black hole or something. Whereas if you do have liquidity, then like Ethereum is a really good example of this. One of the reasons it's been so sticky despite the problems is, well, it's where all the money is. And so if I'm going to build something new and it's a financial system, it's like, do you want to build your TradFi, fintech in New York or in like, no offense to Venezuela, but Venezuela, it's like, you want to build where the money is. Just makes sense. And so we're trying to solve that with the token mint model for AO, basically just like Bitcoin like model, but instead of, paying for waste of electricity, or like usage of electricity, let's say. And actually, like, I think a lot of the eco complaints about Bitcoin are overblown. It's pretty cool for the electricity system, but that's an aside. Here we incentivize what AO needs most, which is the growth of its economy. And so, yeah, we think it's early days, but it really seems to be working, bringing 600 million into a new smart contract ecosystem in a few weeks is not bad.
Hey, and we have Foreverish, so.
Foreverish. Right. Well, actually, interesting, this token mint runs Foreverish too. It halves in distribution like Bitcoin. It just runs, I think it's 110 years or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a ton of other stuff we're interested in with people building agents inside this financial economy, because now you have arbitrary amounts of compute. You can do cool stuff like, yes, it starts with AI MMs, but also like there's a there's a an app on the Perm web called Llama Land, and basically it's a little on-chain universe.
Yeah, like, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It's an MMO basically, but the compute is running in AO. All of the UI, all of the assets are stored on Arweave, so it's fully decentralized. And you can walk around it and you can go visit the Llama King and you can give him a tribute and you can ask him to mint you some Llama coins. And he runs his own monetary policy and basically feeds it into an LLM in the background inside AO, not off chain, but on chain, making it verifiable. Running inside a smart contract, and he'll decide how many tokens you should get for your plea. So if you ask him, you know, like, I'm going to build a Llama temple or something, he might give you more than just, please give me coins, sir, with an E.
I feel like the Curve people would love this. They're all about llamas.
Llamas, yeah.
Yeah.
Funny enough, like when we were first scaling Arweave, it was also about llamas, except it was NFT llamas. They were like, it was a 10K PFP Solana collection of NFTs. And that was the one that we were, when we were shipping the bundling system for Arweave, that was the thing we were, like the client we were serving basically. And then we worked out in the end, there's like 10 million replications of Llama pictures as a result of the Arweave network at this point. It's like 1,000 for each one. It's really obscene in a way.
Wow. It's funny. There's actually another Llama NFT collection on Ethereum for Curve people. It's called the Llamas. It's these AI generated llamas, because it's like the Curve ecosystem mascot.
Why llamas?
For Curve. I forget. I don't know. I
don't know either.
I don't know. I think it's like AMM. They add like an LL to like AMM, so it's like llama. And yeah, so I don't know. It's just it's their thing. It's
we'll ask culture. Michael when we interview him.
So yeah, come on,
where
Michael.
Where did the source of the llama come from? Yeah. It's just like how we asked Sam the source of the elephant. And I think with that said, Sam, any final thoughts here on AO and AR?
No, I mean, if you want to learn more about Arweave.org is the site. And if you want to learn more about AO, go to AO.any, Arweave Gateway, Arweave.net, Arweave.dev, GA.io, and you'll get all the info.
AO.io? I'm just kidding.
No, almost.
Now that'd be catchy.
AO.ar.io if you want to. That's kind of weird.
Arweave.net. One last question, which we ask all our guests before they leave, which is, who would you recommend as a guest and who do you want to see on Flywheel next?
The first thing that came to mind is Satoshi, which is not helpful to you. Sorry.
Yeah, that was our first suggestion. Satoshi, if you're listening, come on. Yeah.
Let me just DM him real quick.
Yeah.
I think there's a ton of people building really cool infrastructure. Someone from the Monero ecosystem, if you haven't already.
Or someone
like Key Jeffries from Loki, now Session, just building a censorship-resistant decentralized routing network. And they have been since Arweave started. I met them way back at the start. And they build a really cool system where you essentially have Tor for instant messaging. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where, like, for a long time, it doesn't see some traction, but not too much. And then in the protests in Iran last summer, suddenly it became the default way of people talking to one another. I just thought that's what crypto is for.
Wow.
Yeah, Key Jeffries, I would say.
Okay.
Looking note there.
Yeah, well, Sam, thanks so much for coming on. And we hope to see you again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's fun.
Thanks.
Thanks, Sam.
Welcome to the Post Game Show. I'm your host, DeFi Dave, here with Capital K. And we are wrapping up an episode with Sam Williams, the founder of ARAO. This was really impressive. This is like probably the first person I've like talked to that questioned like, okay, like why are blockchains the way they are and how can we make them better? It like started off as, it's funny how it started off as this like simple idea of like, oh, like let's save the history of the web with a permanent storage. But it was like, wait a second, why don't we become like the primary storage itself? And it was like, oh, wait, like why don't we actually power all the blockchains with our infrastructure? It's like, it's really interesting seeing this thread. And I think the most poignant part of the interview when he was just like, his why was like, you know, a noble cause, and everything kind of just was kind of pushed by that or pulled by that. Kip, what are your thoughts?
That part too, when he says, when I asked about PMF, and he was like, actually, we don't care because we know this is needed. Yeah. So like for ourselves, like we would need something like this. And I thought that level of conviction, like that principled conviction
would conviction.
Make any like VC like just shrivel up, because they're just like, I can't, I need the money. You know, like tell me about the PMF.
I need the liquidity.
Like, yeah, it's exactly. You know, TTT, time to a token, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so I thought that was really great. And I also love the fact that he just takes things so matter of factly, and since you know he comes from a super technical background with his PhD in computer science and a builder for the past like nearly a decade, so he just comes at things like very matter of fact, like that is wrong, you know, because of XYZ, mm-hmm. you know, and this is the writer way. And I just felt like that was just so refreshing to hear when a lot of people like you so eloquently says like narrative market fit. Right, everyone's trying to squeeze their things into it, but he's just like, no, it just doesn't work. It doesn't work.
Yeah, no, it's more like, okay, this is the thing we're building. This is the thing we believe. You're either with it or you're not with it. But I really enjoyed his takes of Ethereum, because I don't think I've heard that perspective before. I mean, I hear people shouting on Twitter, but then like to have like such a constructive, thought out criticism of Ethereum to someone like that was there and seen the evolution. I don't, it's like, can you imagine hearing that in 2021? We'd be, like Ethereum's like the way, yeah, but like now ETH is king, ultrasound money,
the crown.
As where's ETH at? But now, I mean, I feel like all these blocks, especially, like anything that's been around for a while, especially something like Ethereum, like it's definitely entrenched in like the same ways like Bitcoin's entrenched. And I'm a little bit more optimistic and hopeful for Ethereum just because I'm like that as a person. But I don't know. It was a good take. It was, you know, it was a really good take. Like, why do we need a shared state?
Yeah, there's very few reasons why. And there's obviously solutions around it too as well. Like there is possible that maybe like some processes, which are smart contracts in their sense, could be bundled together. And like maybe there's like a scheduler that would do that bundling for you so that it's effectively a shared state, because this one scheduler schedules like all of these processes together. So it starts a little centralizing a little bit in terms of computation and scalability. But I think like having these ad hoc, like when you need to bundle them situation is much better. And what do you think about the modular and on-demand security?
Oh yeah. I mean, that just makes sense. Like, why do I need like $10 billion of security for my $10 transaction? I don't, I just need like, I don't need that shit. So, with this interview, this was the one that you picked. This is the one you got.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You've been really wanting this one for a while. You got out and got it. I'm just like, all right, let's run it. And so,
like I told you, man, I think this is like the capital. This is all caps primitive, right? All caps primitive, bro.
I mean, it's just, I'm like really interested to see like how this plays out, because it's, I mean, like 7 years ago, this like wasn't possible. All you could do, if you want to do anything, is like Ethereum. It was like the only, even like 4 or 5 years ago. But now you have so many different options. You have so many different VMs. You have so many different modular.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a menu. So you can like choose like what you want. But like AO just makes it easier to like choose that menu. It makes it cheaper. It makes it simpler.
Not only that, bro, you don't have to choose. If you want to run EVM, you can. You want to run SVM, you can. You want to run MoveVM, you can. It's literally anything you want to build on it. It is possible. That's why, like, that's why whenever I thought about it.
It scales arbitrarily.
And it scales. So like a ETH contract can totally interact with a Solana contract.
Yeah, and how he was saying it scales arbitrarily, and I'm trying to think what he was saying. Sorry, it's a long one. This is a long interview, longest interview we did in a while. After an hour, I'm just like,
Yeah. Sorry about that. This was one for me, folks. You know, we do like 9 for Dave and then 1 for me because I know it's
we do like 100. We do 100 for me. Let's be real. Honestly.
Yeah, we do 99 for Dave and 1 for me because I know this is a hard topic, but this is exciting, guys. I'm telling you, like, you know, mark my words here. This is August 1st of 2024. Like, fast forward a year later, 2 years later, 3 years later, like, I feel like AO is going to make a super... It's going to hit a dent in the blockchain universe.
Yeah. And it's going to only be obvious in hindsight. And then you're going to have all the KOLs and threaders talk about it. Many such cases.
Yes, many such cases.
But no, like, it's this decentralized storage is like one of those things that's always like been around. I feel like there's like these themes.
It's also not sexy though.
Yeah, it's not sexy. Yeah. There's like privacy. There's storage. There's fucking social. There's like all this shit that's like been around. Like for years, even like before when we joined, but they just haven't had their moment yet. But like now, because the tech is getting better, it will have its moment and we're going to see what's possible. And, you know, I really like Sam, another good Sam. And going to be fun to see how it all plays out. And if you want to see it play out, you know what to do. Go hit that bell button, subscribe, leave us a comment. Let us know what you think. Give us a like, please. It helps. Make sure you follow us on all of our socials on Twitter, TikTok, and Telegram at Flywheel DeFi. You can follow me, yours truly, DeFi Dave 22 on Twitter. You heard that right, DeFi Dave 22. And
you can follow me at 0xCapital_K.
And we'll see you next week.
Peace.
Everything said on this episode is not financial or tax advice. This channel is strictly for educational purposes and is not in investment advice or solicitation to buy or sell any assets or to make any financial decisions. This video is not tax advice whatsoever. Please talk to your accountant and do your own research.